Welcome to The Nature of Florida, the Sunshine State's only podcast dedicated to its wild and natural places and the fight to preserve them. I'm your host, Oscar Corral, a two-time Emmy Award-winning filmmaker and journalist. I've dedicated much of my career to making films about environmental issues. Tune in each week to hear from a broad range of voices, from scientists to surfers, activists to mermaids, who are working on the front lines to save what's left of Florida's natural beauty and its wildlife. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Nature of Florida podcast. With me here today is a very special guest, Craig Pittman, the well-known and famous environmental journalist from the Tampa Bay Times for many years, and also the author of many books, an award-winning journalist. One of the books he's written, one of my favorites, Oh Florida, How America's Weirdest State Influences the Rest of the Country. And his latest is Cattail, The Wild, Weird Battle to Save the Florida Panther, which is a near and dear to my heart. I did a short documentary a couple years ago about preserving Florida panther. So we're going to talk about that a little bit today. Anyway, it's great to have you on today, Craig. Welcome.
Thanks for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Great. So let's get started. I want to ask you a little bit about your work covering the environment in Florida for so many years. I know that you were an environmental journalist for the Tampa Bay Times for about 20 years or so.
21 years. Yeah.
21 years. And before that, you covered other environmental beat on other newspapers. Tell me about
Sarasota. I covered
Sarasota.
Yeah.
Tell me about how you got into environmental coverage. What drew you to that?
Well, I'm from Florida. I grew up in Florida. So I guess I'm an endangered species anyway. Mm-hmm. Growing up, I would go camping and canoeing with my Boy Scout troop. My dad would take me hunting. So we'd go walk in the woods. Because, in the South, you can't walk in the woods if you're a guy unless you're carrying a gun. That's the only way you can justify it. So, we wouldn't necessarily shoot anything, but we'd go walk in the woods carrying guns. I read a lot of thrillers. My whole family there, we read a lot of murder mysteries and stuff. And when I got to be 14, my great aunt took a big drag on her Pall Mall and said, "I think you're ready for Travis McGee now." And she gave me a John D. McDonald book. And Johnny McDonald, who was a Sarasota writer, famously wrote all these Travis McGee mysteries, but he would slip in environmental messages into them because he was a very early environmental activist battling the building of condos on the Keys and there in Sarasota and things like that. And so that sort of opened my mind to the idea that these places that I love to visit, things that I love to enjoy with my Boy Scout troop and my dad, were things that were not necessarily going to be around very long, that there were fast buck artists, as McDonald kept calling them, who would come in and pave over everything just to get a dollar. And so that was sort of my introduction to what was going on here in Florida. The first beats that I covered were local government and politics, where I saw firsthand how things worked, or rather didn't work a lot of times. And when I got to the Sarasota paper, I'd covered, government stuff for a couple of years, and I was kind of getting burned out. And my boss said, "What would you like to do instead? We really like you. We want to keep you." And I said, "Well, we don't have anybody covering science in the environment. And there's a lot going on in terms of that. There's Moat Marine Lab here and Selby Botanical Gardens." He said, "Let's do that." So for 8 months, I covered environmental stuff and got to know a lot of the basics there. I had some great experiences. I got to go out with a couple of turtle watch volunteers one night who were looking for sea turtles coming up and laying eggs. And that sort of whetted my appetite to do more of that.
Back then, Sarasota must have been booming. It must have been
the 80s.
Built up and, great time to cover that.
Exactly. And it was helpful to me, too, to cover Selby Gardens then, because then later I circled back and wrote a book about them getting charged with wildlife trafficking because they dealt in an endangered orchid they weren't supposed to have. And so that became the genesis for The Son of Scandal, which, as far as I know, is the only book ever classified as true crime / gardening.
Only in Florida.
And so, yeah, exactly. So then I got to the Times, and at first I was in a bureau up in Palm Harbor and teamed up with another reporter to do some environmental coverage up there because there's a lot of development going on. And we did a series of stories about the Anclote River and where it started and how it ended up in Tarpon Springs and how it had influenced the growth and development of the area. That was a fun story to do because basically we got paid to go out and ride around in boats for a while. So that was nice. But I was covering courts and things like that after that. But then finally the environmental beat opened up and I applied for that and got it. And I think all the stuff I had gone through before that, you know, covering local government, I covered three sessions of the state legislature, I covered courts, prepared me for being ready to cover statewide environmental issues, because, you know, so much of that involves state and local government and how it works or doesn't work. And this being America, everything eventually winds up in court. So I was comfortable dealing with court stuff too. So it was a great gig and I was happy to have it. I swear covering the environment in Florida is the greatest job in American journalism.
I saw a tweet you wrote just a couple of days ago that said that it was the best beat in journalism.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's a front row seat to all the beauty and all the ways that it's being destroyed also.
But occasionally you get to tell a story with a happy ending too, which is nice. When those come, people are very grateful about that.
Well, there's one story with a happy ending that I want you to talk a little bit about, because it's something that I think is pertinent to the whole state, because it's a problem happening everywhere. Back in the 80s, Tampa Bay was in pretty bad shape.
Oh yeah.
Mm-hmm. It was doing really badly. And I think there was a big seagrass die off. The bay was polluted. And there was a big statewide consortium of groups that came together to rescue the bay. And, you know, fast forward 30 or 40 years and the bay is in much better shape than it was back then. Mm-hmm. The opposite is happening in Miami, where I'm based out of. Biscayne Bay, I don't know if you've heard about this, but Biscayne Bay is going through a terrible seagrass mm-hmm. die off and it's getting really bad. Tell me about that story with a happy ending. How was Tampa Bay rescued, and is there hope for a place like Biscayne Bay in Miami today?
I think there's a hope for all of them. The big thing they did in Tampa Bay was they said, maybe we should stop dumping raw sewage into the bay. So they built the Howard F. Curran wastewater plant, which was this top of the line, cutting edge sewer treatment plant, and stopped dumping untreated sewage into the bay and instead started treating that stuff. So it's treated within an inch of its life pretty much. And there's a growing movement to use some of that cleaned up sewer water, what they call reclaimed water, for sprinkling on lawns, as opposed to using fresh water, because, you know, the more fresh water you pump out of the ground just to sprinkle your lawn, that's bad for the aquifer. You know, we need that water for drinking, not for keeping
Absolutely.
Your grass
Absolutely.
Green. Yeah. And, you know, so that was the big thing. The other thing though, that is still causing some problems in Tampa Bay, the big source now for the nitrogen and phosphorus and so forth that goes in, obviously people are still over fertilizing their lawns. So that's a problem. But the other problem is air pollution. People driving, it produces these pollutants that go up in the air and then fall back down into the water. And so that's still a problem. That's continuing to be a problem. And so the less people drive and the less they drive fossil fuel powered cars, the cleaner the water is going to be. So, you know, those are two things that you really want to see happen. The Tampa Bay Estuary Program is the consortium you mentioned, and their focus has been on trying to clean up the bay, trying to make it healthy. And their gauge for that is the spread of seagrass, because seagrass is sort of like the canary in the coal mine. And seagrasses now are beyond the level they were at in like mid 1950, that's the standard that they said is, you know, in the mid 1950s is when the seagrass die off started. If we can get back to the point before that, we know we've got a healthy bay, and they are beyond that now. So that's a good sign.
That's great. I mean, can you believe, Craig, could you believe that we are still dumping our sewage offshore in Miami? I mean,
it's out of sight, out of mind, you know,
it's crazy. Miami has the most precious beaches in the United States. People come here from all over the world to enjoy the beach and as tourists, and to go on our bay and fish and kayak and water ski and jet ski, whatever they do. And we still treat our bay and our beaches like a dumping ground. We still dump all our sewage offshore.
Oh yeah. Well, and you see, you know, you watch the health department post these notices about, we have to close this
That's
particular
right.
beach because of the fecal coliform count. That exactly. means there's too much poop in the water, people.
I know.
Can we find another place to put that? You know,
there's such
a disconnect, you know, on that particular issue.
It's nuts.
So it's nuts. Florida does a very bad job handling its poop. That's kind of the bottom line for an awful lot of the problems we have here. If we ever got serious about fixing that problem, it's not a glamorous environmental issue. It's not saving the rainforest, but it's, if we fix that, we save Florida, honestly, you know.
And add to that all the septic tanks that we have around the state.
Oh, good Lord.
That are causing problems, not just in the bay and salt water, but in the springs and other.
In the springs too. Here's a story about that. Under Jeb Bush, they set up a Florida Springs Initiative in order to try and save the springs, all because Jeb went on a canoe trip on the Itchituckmee, and a guy named Jim Stevenson was his guide. And Jim said, "I've got the governor in a canoe. I'm not letting him get away without putting in a plug for saving the springs." So Jim talked him into starting this thing. And so and Jim wound up being in charge of it. And so one of the things they did was they recommended, they made a whole series of recommendations. One of the things they recommended was the legislature pass a law that says people who are on septic tanks need to have the septic tanks inspected, because generally the life of a septic tank is about 30 years. And an awful lot of the more than a million septic tanks we have in Florida are older than 30 years, which is why they're probably leaking.
And they never get inspected.
Right. And so the requirement that they get inspected, and if there's a leak, they need to get them fixed. So they passed the law, but the septic tank owners were outraged. Oh my God, you're going to make us pay for something? Oh, good heavens. And they objected so strongly that the legislature cut the funding for it initially, and then they repealed the law, and Rick Scott signed off on the repeal. And so when people were calling him Red Tide Rick, it's like, well, that's kind of why, because you agreed with repealing the law that would have helped with that, because the septic tank waste fuels these red tide algae blooms. And even the sponsor of the bill to repeal it, says now, yeah, that was a big mistake. We shouldn't have done that. Because now the state's having to pay for replacing these septic tanks. So you and I, the taxpayers, even though we may be on the sewer system, we're having to pay for replacing somebody else's septic tanks when it should be their responsibility.
The whole environmental movement suffered under Rick Scott, I think. I remember for a documentary I'm bringing out now about the Florida Springs, which we'll talk about in a minute. I remember doing research and getting some, filing some public records requests and finding out that under Rick Scott, the budgets for water management districts and the DEP dropped by as much as 70% during his tenure while he was governor. And mm-hmm. so that put a lot of environmental projects on the shelf and they never went forward. And he also canceled things like the Florida Springs Initiative and other things.
Yeah.
So in a way, the state is still kind of recovering from that. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, politically speaking, Craig, what is Florida facing right now on environmental issues? Are people, and I know that there are, the Republicans, as our viewers should know, Republicans run the state of Florida right now. They have, they control the governor's mansion as well as the House and the Senate in Florida.
Right. So they're, and pretty much have since 1999.
For about 20 years now. So basically, we've been a single party state for about 20 years. So anything that's going to happen in this state has to go through the Republican leadership. And there are, I've interviewed many Republicans who are, they have the conservation mind. And they're conservation minded. And so they want to do the right thing for the environment. But it seems like the political machine is so focused on development that sometimes the conservation minded Republicans lose out and their voices are lost in the shuffle. What is tell me about the politics of Florida right now for environmental issues.
Well, here's the thing we run into, and Jeb started this, which was if you're supporting things that are bad for the environment, if you say, yes, but I'm saving the Everglades, and you throw a lot of money at the Everglades, then people are like, oh, well, he's not so bad. And so you can get away with an awful lot of other stuff as long as you say, well, I support saving the Everglades. So we saw that with Jeb. We saw that with Rick Scott. And we're seeing it now with Ron DeSantis as well. Ron DeSantis, who supported building, there's one of the biggest controversies in Florida. A couple of years ago, the legislature passed this bill to say, we want to build these three super expensive toll roads that DOT sees absolutely no need for. And that came up because Bill Galvano, who then was Senate president, is a lawyer from Bradenton, got a big campaign contribution from the Florida Road Builders Association. And so this is something they were pushing. They wanted it. Nobody else wanted it. And Galvano sold this as being a big help for all the rural communities that had not gotten a lot of development. Those rural counties now are passing resolutions saying, we don't want these roads. We don't want development. We like the way we are. We don't want to, you know, they say, we don't want to East Coast to West Coast. We don't want to be like Tampa. We don't want to be like Miami. We want to be, you know, Levy County. We don't want to be like those other places.
And those toll roads are gonna cut through environmentally sensitive areas if they're built. Yes. Will they not?
Including panther habitat, including the
panther habitat in South Florida, spring sheds up in the north. Yep. So these are places. These are roads that would really not just the construction of the road itself, but the development that they would bring could further harm Florida's what's left of Florida's environment.
Right. So after this bill passed, people were begging the governor, please veto this. And instead of vetoing it, he signed it. And his justification for signing it was people need roads, which is, you know, that's let's just say that's intellectually specious and move on. But he could always say, but look at all I'm doing for the Everglades. I'm spending money on the Everglades. And gee, aren't I a good environmentalist as a result? And also, I want to wipe out the pythons in the Everglades. That's the other big thing he's been pushing.
Right. It's true. Everything that DeSantis has done for the environment has been focused. Well, not everything, but many things have been focused around the Everglades. And, you know, having just finished this documentary series, which is coming out soon on the Springs, it's called The Fellowship of the Springs. I interviewed a lot of people who felt frustration that all of the funding and focus of Florida's government for the environment was in South Florida, where in North Florida, I mean, the Springs are as distinct and unique as the Everglades are in the South. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're as unique as the geysers of Yellowstone National Park. They're these incredibly beautiful national and international treasures that we have in Florida. And yet they kind of get neglected. A lot of attention to them, and they at least not at the leadership level, and they give them kind of a nominal amount of funding every year. Mm-hmm. And these springs are in bad shape. They're hurting.
And
which brings me back to you, because when I got started researching that documentary, I remember I read as much as I could about the springs, and one of the best things I read about the springs was a series you wrote in 2014 about what was happening at the springs. This is 7 years ago, so you were ahead of the curve. Tell me about that series. What drove you to write about the springs, and why choose that?
Well, I had done a story about problems that visitors were having. They were coming to these springs that were state parks and reporting that they were coming out with rashes because they had come in contact with toxic algae blooms, specifically Lingbia in these springs. And I thought, wow, Lingbia in the springs, that's kind of weird. Why are they having problems with algae blooms? So I wound up talking to people, including Jim Stevenson, the guy I mentioned before, Robert Knight, who runs the Florida Springs Institute, and other folks like that, some people with the Florida Geological Survey, and discovered that this was actually a fairly widespread problem, and it was a growing problem, and it was tied to not just the pollution in the spring shed area from farms and so forth, but also tied to the loss of flow from people over pumping water out of the aquifer, that as a result, the flow in the springs was slowing down. And in a couple of cases, it even reversed. So I went and pitched it to my boss and said, we need to do, this is a much bigger story. And he agreed. It was a guy named Roy LeBlanc, one of the best editors I ever worked for. And Roy said, yeah, let's go for that. And so, he gave me the time to work on it, which is, that's the most precious gift you can give a reporter is time.
Oh, isn't it? That's so true.
And so I traveled to a bunch of these springs. I interviewed people. I interviewed, you know, like the canoe rental people, and cave divers were a huge resource for me because these are the people who were going into the aquifer and swimming around and could tell me specifically, yeah, I had a hard time getting into this spring 5 years ago, but now I can swim right in because the flow isn't as bad. It's not as strong anymore. And here's the reason. I talked to some divers who went into Sulphur Springs in Tampa, and the pollution in there was so bad that it was actually eating away at the rubber on their suits. It was nasty. And so and I talked to people who run a church camp up in North Florida that was built around a spring, and the spring flow had become so dormant, except in the rainy season, that it was not healthy to swim in it anymore. And they ended up having to build a separate aquatic complex, a pool and like a $1 million pool and slide complex in order to keep going as a church camp, because they couldn't count on the spring being there anymore. And it was a really sad story. And at this point, Rick Scott had ended that Florida Springs initiative that Jeb Bush had launched. And as a result of these stories, Rick Scott suddenly discovered, oh, we have springs. We need to do something about that. So he started throwing money at that too. But here's the thing. This is kind of the point I was getting to mentioning DeSantis in the Everglades, is that our political leaders, if you point out there's a problem, they'll throw money at fixing things, but they won't do anything about the root cause. So for instance, you know, we went through 8 years with Rick Scott of denying that climate change existed. Now we have Ron DeSantis, who he won't say the words, but he's putting money into resilience, which is we're going to figure out a way to cope with rising sea levels. We're going to figure out how to cope with, other aspects of climate change, but we're not going to do anything about the things that are causing climate change. We're not going to try and move away from, fossil fuel powered power plants and things like that. So, it's a totally backwards way to approach things, but that's the way we do things in Florida.
Why do you think that is, Craig? Why do you think Florida has that? You think it's because it's a single party state and there's little accountability?
No, I think it's because it's easy. We have legislators who go into office and they're not there very long because of term limits. And so they don't really have time to build up any expertise on a subject. And instead, they wind up relying on mostly on lobbyists to tell them what's going on. And the lobbyists, of course, are not there to lobby for the environment. They're there to lobby for their well-heeled clients, who tend to be developers and, the utility industry and boat manufacturers and things like that. The environment doesn't have that much of a voice. I mean, there are lobbyists for environmental groups there, but they're seen as special interests by the legislators, not as, someone who can tell you, hey, this is a way you can set things apart. The interesting thing to me is the public is so far ahead of their quote unquote leaders on these things. So we've seen passage of constitutional amendments trying to tell the legislators, hey, these are the things we think are important. We think you should be spending more money on buying up environmental land, for instance. And the legislators ignore it and subvert it and try and get around it somehow every time, as if they feel like they know better than their constituents do.
Well, I remember voting on Amendment 1 a few years ago that was supposed to allocate $300 or $400 million a year to purchase environmentally sensitive land all over the state. And the state proceeded to ignore it and maybe allocate, a few tens of millions of dollars, 50, 60 million. But the bulk of that money was not spent on acquiring land, was it? What happened?
Right. Well, the legislature kind of ignored it and said, oh, well, we're going to count salaries in that. And we're going to count replacing septic tanks in that. And so we're going to use that money for that. And we're going to call it complying with Amendment 1, even though it doesn't really. I mean, they've been doing the same thing ever since we passed the lottery. You know, the lottery was supposed to improve funding for education. And instead, the legislators said, you know what, we're going to take that money and put it to education. But as a result, we're going to take money out of education that we were spending over there. So it ends up being a wash. And it's been like that ever since.
Why is the environment such a tricky issue in Florida, Craig? I mean, talk about how Florida has grown over the last 30, 40, 50 years. I mean, what's happened in this state? You go outside and, places that used to be wild just 10 or 15 or 20 years ago are suddenly booming with development. I mean, where is this sustainable? Where are we heading right now?
Florida has a long history of undervaluing its environmental riches for the longest time, 30s, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. The idea is that stuff's valueless as it is. It's only worth something if we can build things there. The early settlers, they didn't live at the beach. They didn't value the beach because you couldn't plow it. You couldn't plant anything, and so gradually people have started to figure out that maybe the environment has a value for tourists and possibly even for home buyers. But not as a thing itself. They still don't see it as, that a Florida scrub jay is worth preserving just because it's a Florida scrub jay and not because it's something that appeals to birders coming to check out the Florida birding trail. I talked to a guy named Dexter Filkins, who grew up in Cocoa.
Sure. He worked at the Herald and New York Times eventually.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. he's with the New Yorker now, and he made the great observation that growing up in Florida is like being the kid in the Sixth Sense, because you're constantly seeing things that nobody else sees, things that aren't there anymore. You know, oh, that used to be an orange grove. Oh, that used to be, you know, a forest where you could find, you know, all kinds of interesting birds. You know, that used to be a marsh where you'd see roseate spoonbills, and now it's all condos and parking lots and storage centers and things that, you know, they may add to the economy, but they don't add to the richness of life in Florida. Bob Graham, when he was governor, he used to have a phrase that he would trot out frequently, which was, don't kill the goose that lays the golden egg. In other words, don't kill off the thing that attracts people to Florida, or you'll end them coming to Florida. We haven't reached that point yet, but boy, it sure feels like we're close every single day. A big thing with that, and this was, he would use this phrase usually in conjunction with a discussion of an agency that doesn't exist anymore, which is the Florida Department of Community Affairs. For 20 years or so, we had this great state agency that was in charge of coordinating and overseeing growth in Florida and managing it and making sure that, you know, growth in one county, some new project in one county, wouldn't screw things up in the next county over. And they were not perfect. They made mistakes. They were human, but they were the ones kind of watching out for some of this stuff. And when the legislature and Rick Scott got into office that were so pro-business, they didn't see any value in the environment, they killed it. They got rid of the Department of Community Affairs. And so now the only agency that's kind of controlling growth in Florida is the Florida Department of Transportation. They build a road, growth follows. And that's kind of where we're at these days. Nobody is minding the store and making sure that the growth that we get is the kind that we want.
What do you think is the most effective way for people to care about the environment? I mean, I'm from Miami, and I know people who from here who have never even been to the Everglades. What's the best way to get people to care? Plus the extra challenge of being Florida, where a lot of people who live here are newcomers. They're immigrants from another country, like my parents who came here from Cuba, or there are people who come in from other states like New York or California or Chicago or Illinois. And they move here and they may not know about Florida's environment and what it has to offer other than beaches, Disney World, and maybe the Everglades. What's the best way to get people to care?
One thing I do a lot is I talk about our state park system. Our state park system is so great. It's actually won national awards 4 times, which is 3 times more than any other state has won it. I mean, that's how great we are. And it's got this surprising diversity to it. I mean, it's, you know, you've got the beaches, the beautiful beaches like Topsail Hill up in the Panhandle, Honeymoon Island over in Dunedin, which is actually the most visited state park in Florida. And you can't camp there, and there's hardly any facilities, but that's what people find appealing about it. We've got Falling Waters State Park up in the Mariana area, where there's actually a waterfall in Florida. You wouldn't think you could find a waterfall in Florida.
I have never seen that. I got to see that.
And it falls, the water falls into a sinkhole, so you never see where it ends up. So it's got that sort of air of mystery to it. We've got the Devil's Mill Hopper outside Gainesville, where it's a sinkhole that has developed different ecosystems at different layers as you go down on the boardwalk. And of course, I can't forget Wekiwatchee Springs, where makes Florida the only state that has mermaids on the government payroll. I always love mentioning that. A lot of the springs, the best springs, are state parks. There's just so much to choose from. There's some great hiking trails. There's a website called Florida Hikes that offers lots of advice on where to go hiking. And the people who run that website have published several guidebooks to hiking in Florida, including the Florida Hiking Trail, which is a statewide trail that starts down in the south and goes all the way up through the Panhandle. So anything you can do to convince people to get outdoors and check out the state parks or check out the state trail system or the state forests, I think you're getting them there. If you can get them outdoors and get them to see what Florida's like in its natural state, to go canoeing or kayaking, even just to go out and see some beautiful sunsets and gorgeous rainbows, I think that gets them sort of started along the path of seeing, you know, what a special place this is. Plus, we have a number of festivals. I was just talking to somebody today about the Great Florida Birding Festival. It's going to be coming up in October, and they're going to having some events here in Tampa Bay, including one at Apollo Beach. to sort of celebrate the marvelous bird population here in Florida, because we've got not just our own native birds, but we're a pass-through for a lot of migrating birds that come from up north and are headed to Cuba and South America and so forth, as well as the monarch butterflies that stop off in St. Mark's National Wildlife Refuge up in the Panhandle.
I started this podcast because I think it's important for people to, first of all, to know what we have out there in Florida. A lot of people are like me. They grew up in an urban area, and maybe they didn't have parents who took them often into nature. You're lucky you did. I really didn't. So I kind of came across it later in my life. And when I did, I just found it to be therapeutic. I found it to be even spiritual, you know, just a great, a great way
it's very soothing.
To clear your mind. It's very soothing. And I think that's so important. And so, look, I'm an urban kid. I grew up in Miami, and, you know, I went to the beaches a few times, and when I'd go north, I'd get sucked into the gravitational pull of Disney, and I never made it north of Disney. I never made it to a spring. I never made it to anything else. It was Disney or bust if you went north. So, you know, and that's fine. I'm not, you know, hammering Disney or anything, but what I'm saying is there's definitely more to Florida. And what you said is about, you know, what you said about getting out there and viewing and experiencing these state parks is the best way to build empathy and to understand what we've got, because Florida's nature is incredibly precious, and it's just something that that you can't build it, you can't pay for it. It's there, it's ours, and all we got to do is take care of it. That's all we need to do. Just take care of it. Just not destroy it. I mean, is that so difficult? You know,
Apparently, I mean, there was a time not too long ago where there was actually talk of building golf courses in some of the state parks. Fortunately,
and people, grazing cattle and all these crazy.
Fortunately, none of that happened. But boy, it was like for a while there, it was like, really, that's how you think you're going to improve on what's out there.
Crazy.
So,
all right. Well, Craig, anything
we got it.
Anything else you want to add before we sign off? Anything else you want to?
Is it okay if I plug my podcast?
Absolutely. Go for it.
I started a podcast with a guy named Chad Scott. We put new ones out every week. It's called Welcome to Florida. Our attitude is 900 new people move to Florida every day. Nobody's telling them what they've gotten themselves into. So we've decided we're going to do it. And we've done interviews with a python hunter, a gator wrangler, a nudist, guy who wrote a book on the villages, an expert on cockroaches, and Carl Hyacin and Clyde Butcher, the photographer. So we're working on trying to cover the whole state.
Wonderful. Well, I definitely tune in, and it's a wonderful podcast. If you haven't heard it, check it out. Welcome to Florida. Craig, thanks again for joining me and for your time.
Pleasure. All right. Take care.
This episode of the Nature of Florida podcast was brought to you in part by the Felburn Foundation, the Fish and Wildlife Foundation of Florida, and Explica Media. If you're enjoying this podcast, remember to subscribe on our website, The Nature of Florida with Oscar Corral.buzzsprout.com. That's The Nature of Florida with Oscar Corral.buzzsprout.com. Or find us on your favorite platform and follow us on Facebook and Instagram.